any need for legislative action that the courts feel is appropriate. I have to tell you that if I were to be confirmed as an initial matter, I think my primary posture is going to be one of listening, because there's obviously much I have to learn about matters of concern to different judges, different courts around the country. And that's the good thing about the Judicial Conference, of course. They bring in judges from around the country to make sure that you get a national perspective on what needs to be done, and you're not just focused on issues here in Washington or anywhere else. But it's an area where I think I will have to listen a lot at the outset before being presumptuous enough to have a particular agenda.
I thank you, Judge Roberts. I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator Kroll. Senator DeWine.
This is Mike DeWine, Republican of Ohio.
Good afternoon.
You know, Judge, our Constitution created federal courts with limited powers. In fact, Article 3 of the Constitution only gives the federal courts the power to decide cases and controversies. This case and controversy requirement means that federal courts will only hear real lawsuits involving real parties with real injuries. We've talked about this in the last several days. This has led to the development of a number of different rules about when people can bring lawsuits in federal court and when they cannot. One of these rules, as you well know, is the principle of standing. You talked about this in 1993 in a law review article you wrote in the Duke Law Journal. You said the following, I'm going to quote briefly from this. The legitimacy of an unelected, life-tenured judiciary in our democratic republic is bolstered by the constitutional limitation of that judiciary's power in Article 3 to actual cases and controversies. You went on later to state the following. The Article 3 standing requirement ensures that the court is carrying out its function.
Let me apologize for the quality of the audio. We're getting a feed from the committee, from the floor, and clearly they have not opened Senator DeWine's microphone, but we'll try to listen to what he has to say from the microphone next door.
Judge, could you elaborate on these statements today and maybe explain briefly what the doctrine of standing is and why that doctrine is really so important to our constitutional system?
Well, Senator, your question really ties together a few themes we've already touched on. I don't remember if it was you or someone else who referenced Justice White's description of his obligation and what it was, and his answer was to decide cases.
That was me.
And the basis for the institution of judicial review, as explained by Chief Justice John Marshall in Marbury versus Madison, is similarly grounded on the obligation to decide cases and controversies. Because if you look at the Constitution, it doesn't say in Article 3 that the judicial branch is established in order to tell us all what the Constitution means. It says that the judicial branch is established to decide cases and controversies arising under this Constitution and the laws. And that is the basis for the authority to interpret the Constitution. As Marshall explained, we have to decide a case. If the argument is that it's inconsistent with the Constitution, we have to decide that. Therefore, we have that authority, and I believe that's consistent with the intent of the framers. But it does mean, and this is the point I was trying to make in that small little law review comment, that judges should be very careful to make sure they've got a real case or controversy before them, because that is the sole basis for the legitimacy of them acting in the manner they do in a democratic republic. They're not accountable to the people. As judges, they have the obligation to decide cases according to the rule of law. So first make sure you've got a real case. And a real case is not simply, you know, I'm interested in this area, I don't like what the government's doing, or I don't like this law, and so I'm going to go to court. What the standing doctrine requires is that you actually be injured by what the government is doing, injured by Congress's action. Now, the injury doesn't have to be economic. The Supreme Court has explained in cases like Sierra Club versus Morton, it can be aesthetic, it can be environmental. It can cover a wide range of injuries, but you do have to show some injury that separates you from the general public. So you're just not voicing a gripe. You're trying to get a case decided. That's the importance of the standing doctrine.
I appreciate the explanation, Judge. Let me ask you a more personal question. Last time you appeared before our committee, you were a lawyer in private practice. Since that time, you've spent approximately 2 years on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. new experience for even an experienced practitioner like you. What surprised you about the last 2 years of judging?
Well,
if anything.
Well, I think I had the biggest surprise on the first day that I heard cases. Obviously, it's opening day and first day in my career, so I prepared as good as well as I could. The arguments were great, and went into the conference room, and I had my notes and all the books. It's just the judges, you know, just the three judges. We bring the record in. We're surrounded by the U.S. reports, by our Court of Appeals reports, by the United States Code that you folks have written. And I was ready, and I'm sitting there, and I remember the chief judge who by tradition sits on a new judge's first day, and he was there and another judge, and I waited a while, and I looked, and they were still waiting. I waited a while longer, and they were still waiting, and finally the chief judge advised me that the tradition was that the junior judge goes first at these discussions, and so I was kind of put on the spot right off the bat. And part of what that conference was like and throughout really has, I don't know if I'd say a surprise, but it's been illuminating to me. The judges really do roll up their sleeves and try to find the right answer. It's just the judges. But as we say, well, we think this case is controlled by the Smith case. We get out the Smith case. We open it up and we look at it. Reading over each other's shoulders and seeing exactly what it says. If somebody says, well, but in this case, under the record, there was no evidence about this, or there was no objection raised about that. Well, you get out the record and you look, and there at page, you know, 223, you point to it and say, well, here's where the objection was raised. And the judges are very open. It's a very encouraging part of the process from my point of view. Nobody goes in there with set views. They want the benefit of the collegial process, the benefit of each other's views, and you have to be able to substantiate your position. There's no place for rhetoric. People are pointing to the law. And I found that a very encouraging part of the process, what goes on in the conference room, which was, of course, a part of the process that I hadn't participated in before.
That's something we don't see either.
Right.
No way of seeing it.
Right. And the positive part of that process to me was that nobody was invested in anything other than getting the right result. And they're prepared to be convinced, contrary to initial impressions, and I was as well. I found a very encouraging part of the process.
Judge, let me ask you, moving to the administrative law issue, if I could. As you know, in the 18th and 19th centuries, we really did not have governmental agencies that have such a profound influence, for better or worse, on the lives of Americans today, daily lives of Americans. Today, administrative agencies set workplace safety rules, establish environmental regulations, lay down traffic safety standards, just to name a few things. But as far as I know, there's no specific article in the Constitution dedicated to the administrative state that we live in today. In your view, what is there in the text or history of the Constitution that supports the growth of this administrative state that we live in? Is the growth of the administrative state an example of the Constitution being amended simply out of necessity, or is the administrative state consistent with the Constitution as drafted by our founding fathers? How do we get to where we are from a constitutional point of view?
Well, you know, we all, of course, begin in high school civics with the notion of three branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, and we study that, and then only occasionally do people look at the real world and see, well, what is this agency? What is that? Is that legislative, or is that judicial, or is that executive? And, of course, the answer is, well, it's a little bit of each. It's exercising power delegated by Congress. It's executing it in a particular way. It's issuing regulations that have the force and effect of law, and quite often it's adjudicating particular disputes. The activities of the administrative agencies are, of course, the bulk of what the judges on the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit do, and the principles of administrative law that have recognize the legitimacy of these agencies and sought to ensure that their exercise of authority is consistent with constitutional provisions by basically, I mean, I know the issue can seem arcane to many people, but the fundamentals of administrative law really go back to the basic principles of justice. Is someone being given an opportunity to be heard? Is someone being treated fairly? Is someone who's making a decision doing it for a rational reason or an arbitrary reason? These are the same basic principles that have animated the common law system since the time of Lord Cook, and they're being applied here as well. And the objection is often, this agency made a decision without adequately hearing our concerns, or this agency made an adjudicatory decision without hearing the record evidence, or they did not explain. That's the basic requirement of administrative law. Explain your decision. That's the limitation on arbitrariness. And the agency didn't explain why it's doing this. The notion that even in these arcane areas, our legal system insists upon the observance of these basic requirements of, I don't want to use it, say, due process as a technical term, but that's the principle that is being applied. That goes a long way to explaining how these agencies have been accepted into the constitutional system, because they've been required under principles of administrative law to comply with these basic precepts of procedural regularity.
Judge, let me turn to the area of antitrust, a matter that's very important for the businesses and the consumers of this country. For over 100 years, our antitrust laws have helped consumers by ensuring that our economy is competitive and vibrant. Our antitrust laws are the oldest in the world, and many and people, including me, think they're the best in the world. In fact, I'm proud to say that John Sherman, Republican senator from my own home state of Ohio, wrote the first antitrust law back in 1890. Over the past 20 years, we've achieved a great deal of consensus, I think, about how the antitrust laws should be enforced, Democrat and Republican administrations. As the chair of this committee, subcommittee on antitrust, competition, policy, and consumer rights, I've worked very closely with Senator Cole, who asked you some questions about antitrust. I think we've worked in a bipartisan way to ensure that consumers and competition are protected. It's a simple goal, but it's not so always easy to achieve or put into practice. For example, recently the rise and expansion of the Internet and the technological explosion of the so-called new economy have led to a marketplace that's changing faster and more often than we have really ever experienced before. Judge, what challenges do you think the courts face in trying to square our old antitrust laws as they're currently written with new business strategies in the high-technology markets? And do you think that the laws, these laws give courts enough guidance to deal with these new economy issues?
Well, that was really the basic issue that I faced in the Microsoft case before the D.C. Circuit en banc. There was a lot of argument, academic commentary back and forth, the idea this is a whole new area, you can't apply the old principles, they don't work in this context, you need to do something different. The so-called new paradigm and all that. And at least the argument that I tried to make on behalf of the states was that the basic principles are the same. The Sherman Act was, as many have said, you know, a charter of economic freedom, and that those basic principles do have to be applied regardless of changes in the economics of the underlying businesses or the structure of the markets. Obviously, it requires a great deal of sensitivity on the part of the judges, and it's a real challenge for the lawyers sometimes to be able to understand the economics, to be able to explain them to the judges, and judges appreciate that. But my basic instinct, and it's nothing more than that, is that the principles are there, and the issue is simply application in a new context.
Good. Great. Thank you. Judge, just one final comment. Yesterday, Senator Grassley asked you whether you think that there is, and I quote, any room in constitutional interpretation for the judge's own values or beliefs. In response, you said, and I quote, "No, I don't think there is. Sometimes it's hard to give meaning to a constitutional term in a particular case. But you don't look to your own values and beliefs. You look outside yourself to other sources. End of quote. You continued by saying that, and I quote, judges wear black robes because it doesn't matter who they are as individuals. That's not going to shape their decision. It's their understanding of the law that will shape their decision. End of quote. Now, Judge, I know what you meant by that answer. Judges should not impose their own preferences from the bench. In fact, I said pretty much the same thing in my opening statement on Monday. But, Judge, putting on a black robe does not mean that a judge should lose his character. You, sir, have a perfect resume, and certainly an outstanding professional career. But a Supreme Court justice is more than just impeccable academic credentials and impressive accomplishments. President Bush nominated John Roberts the man. America has gotten to know John Roberts the man. And I'm quite sure that the Senate is, in fact, going to confirm John Roberts, the man. Over the past several months, we've examined your life, met with you in private, and now question you about your beliefs. Throughout this time, your honesty, your integrity, your wisdom, your judgment, and dare I say, yes, your values have shown through. I would just say, sir, please don't check any of that at the door when you walk into the Supreme Court. By becoming John Roberts, the Chief Justice, don't ever forget to be John Roberts, the man. I think this country needs you to remember how you got here and who you met along the way. We need you to bring to the court your compassion and your understanding for the lives of others who haven't been as successful as you have been. We need you to bring to the court your strong commitment to equal justice for all. And we need you to always remember that your decisions will make a real difference in the lives of real people. When you put on that black robe and assume your spot on the Supreme Court, you will truly bring with you your heart and your soul. The values you learned from your parents and others that you learned as you grew up in the wide open fields of your youth. Those values are strong, they are true. The President saw them when he nominated you, and we have certainly seen them this week. And I must say, sir, that they must never leave you. Justice Felix Frankfurter gave this same advice to his colleagues in 1949. There comes a point, Justice Frankfurter wrote, where this court should not be ignorant as judges of what we know as men. Great justices are more than just legal automatons, legal technicians. They're more than just that. And though they lose their individuality when they put on a black robe, great justices never forget who they are. I wish you well. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Senator DeWine. Senator Feinstein?
Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Judge, I subscribe to much of what Senator DeWine said. I want to tell you what I think, perhaps a little differently and personally. Senator Graham last night pointed out that Justice Scalia was confirmed by 98 votes of this body. And I thought then, and I think now, how different the days were in 1986. There's so much water under the dam since then. The nation is divided. It's polarized. That's about 50-50. We're at war. Executive authority is very much on people's minds. The law as it relates to war, the Geneva Conventions, the Conventions Against Torture, all of these things very much on everyone's minds. We've seen in the last 10 years 193 5-4 decisions of the court, which suggests that on major questions, the court is also very divided. And so in comes this young justice. I was one on our side that voted for you for the D.C. court. I did so because there were so many testimonials about what a fine lawyer you are, what a fine human being you are, and I voted for you. But there's more in this vote. Senator DeWine just spoke about the man as opposed to the legal automaton. Yesterday morning, you spoke, I thought, eloquently in answering Senator Spector's questions on Roe. You discussed stare decisis as fully as I have ever heard it discussed. I'm not a lawyer. I learned a lot from listening to you. You discussed the right to privacy. You were very full and forward speaking. And then after lunch, it was as if you shut down and became very cautious. So my first question, did anybody caution you between the morning and the afternoon sessions?
No, Senator, no.
Has anyone, when you were being interviewed for this position, ever asked your opinion on Roe?
No.
Okay, that's good to know. In 1973, 2005, 32 years, over three generations of women have come really to feel that finally they have some autonomy over their body. And, you know, women are all different. Many of them are very pro-life. Many are pro-choice. People have different religious views, moral views. So it's this big, diverse cosmopolitan of women. But the growth has been enormous, and the ability of women to succeed. I mean, I went into the workforce at the same time Sandra Day O'Connor did with a year's graduate work. The door was closed. It's now open, and women are so lucky. And it seems to me that the living constitution is that each person in this great country, man or woman, you know, rich or poor, white or black, whatever it might be, can really reach their full potential. And I guess what has begun to concern me a little bit is Judge Roberts, the legal automaton, as opposed to Judge Roberts, the man, because I've heard so many times, you know, I can't really say because it may come before me. And yet I don't expect you to say what you would do with Roe one way or another. But I do expect to know a little bit more about how you feel and how you think as a man, because you're a very young man to be Chief Justice. You could be Chief Justice for 40 years. That's a very long time. And because of the division, and there's also a lot of fear out there, where this new court, now with potentially two new justices, is going to go, whether you've got the ability to bring that court together, to end the 5-4 decisions, to see that big decisions are made so that they represent a much greater consensus. And I'm trying to find out and see, are those qualities really there? I was interested in a colloquy you had with Senator Biden on the end of life, and he used the word, he asked a number of legal questions, and then he says, okay, just talk to me as a father and tell me. Now, I've been through two end-of-life situations, one with my husband, one with my father, both suffering terrible cancers, a lot of pain, enormous debilitation. Let me ask this question this way. If you were in that situation with someone you deeply love and you saw the suffering, who would you want to listen to? your doctor, or the government telling you what to do? To me, it's that stark, because I've been through it.
Well, Senator, in that situation, obviously, you want to talk and take into account the views and the heartfelt concerns of the loved one that you're trying to help in that situation, because you know how they're viewing this. You know what they mean when they're saying things like what their wishes are and their concerns are. And, of course, consulting with their physician. But it seems to me that in that situation, you do want to understand and make sure that you appreciate the views of the loved one. And only you can do it because...
That wasn't my question.
I'm sorry.
I'm trying to see your feelings as a man. I'm not asking you for a legal view.
Well, I wasn't trying to give a legal view. My point was that, obviously, you look to the views of the person involved, and if it's a loved one, you are the one who is in a position to make sure that you understand their views and can help them communicate those.
How would you feel if you were in that position?
An end-of-life situation and suffering. You know, I do think it's one of those things that it's hard to conceptualize until you're there. I really would be hesitant to say this is what I would definitely want done or that's what I would definitely want done. You do need to confront that and appreciate all of the different concerns and impulses and considerations.
And every situation is different.
Yes. And it's one of those things I think it's difficult to put yourself in that position and saying, well, with any degree of confidence, if I were suffering and confronting the end of life, this is what I would want to do or that is what I would want to do. You can theorize it and try to come up with your views or how you would confront.
That's right. All I'm saying is you wouldn't want the government telling you what to do.
Well, I'm happy to say that as a general matter.
That there should be a basic right of privacy.
Well, that's getting into a legal question,
okay,
and you don't
want...
I won't
go there. I won't go there. Let me go somewhere else. Commerce Clause, the 14th Amendment, Lopez, which began a chain of about 36 cases, striking down major pieces of legislation. It's not easy to get a bill passed here. I mean, there are hearings, there are discussions, there are markups. There's one house, there's another house, there's a president. It goes through most of the time, scrubbed pretty good before it gets to the president. Gun-free schools, struck down in 1995. An impermissible use of a Commerce Clause. 96, Moses Lake, Washington, shooting in a school. 97, Bethel, Alaska, principal and one student killed. 97, Pearl, Mississippi, two students killed and seven wounded by a 16-year-old. 1997, West Paducah, three students killed, five wounded. Stamps, Arkansas, two students wounded. Jonesboro, 98, four students, one teacher killed, 10 others wounded outside West Side Middle School. Edinburgh, Pennsylvania, one teacher killed, two students, and on and on and on. An impermissible use of the Commerce Clause to prohibit possession of a weapon in schools. Now, at what point does crime influence commerce?
Well, I think it does. And one of the things that's important to understand about the Lopez decision as the court analyzed it, and again, I'm not taking a position on whether it was correctly decided or not, but as the court analyzed it, one of the things about the act was that it did not have what's known as a jurisdictional requirement. It didn't have a requirement that the firearm be transported in interstate commerce. Requirement that I would think it would be easy to meet in most cases because gun...
But the firearm is transported in interstate commerce. Maybe not when that student had it, but to get to the student, the firearm has been transported in interstate commerce.
My point is that the fix in Lopez, all that the court was saying was missing in there, or what was different about Lopez than many of the other cases, was that lack of a jurisdictional requirement. And if the Act had been, as I understand the Court's analysis, if the Act had required that, which I think, again, it's fairly easy to show in almost every case, as you say, these guns are transported in interstate commerce, then that would have been within the Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. I think it was an unusual feature of the legislation that it didn't have that requirement, as so many laws do. As you know, it often says, you know, in interstate commerce. And that's, at least as I understand the Lopez decision, what made it unusual.
That's very helpful. You might get it back again someday with that fix. Let me turn to something else that Senator Leahy asked a number of questions on, and that's the Constitution and executive power. I'm looking for the section, but the Constitution very clearly says that any treaty is treated as the supreme law of the land, right? And that no state or official can abrogate it.
Right.
Which gives it the total weight of law. Can a president then decide not to follow a treaty?
As a general matter, the answer is no. The treaty power, as long as it's ratified according to the requirements in the Constitution by two-thirds of the Senate, you're perfectly correct. It is, under the Supremacy Clause, the supreme law of the land. Now, I don't know if there are particular arguments about executive authority in that area with which I'm not familiar, and I don't mean to state categorically, but my general understanding is that treaties that are ratified, and of course we have treaties that aren't ratified and executive agreements that aren't submitted for ratification and so on, but a treaty that's ratified by the Senate under the Supremacy Clause is part of the supreme law of the land. Now,
so the conventions against torture and the Geneva Conventions would apply?
Yes. Now, there are questions, of course, that arise under those and have arisen under those about interpreting the conventions and how they apply in particular cases to non-parties to the convention and so on. And as you know, those cases have been coming up and are being litigated. But that's an issue of what the convention means in a particular case, not whether, as a general matter, a treaty is binding.
Let me take you to the morning, yesterday morning, in Stare Decisis, because you specifically discussed, when you were asked about Roe and Casey, precedent, specifically, as we said, workability, reliance, pragmatic considerations, changed facts or circumstances, and whether the underlying legal or constitutional doctrine would still be valid. Are there any other factors that you think should be considered?
Well, the Court has been somewhat inconsistent on some other factors. They, for example, talk about, in some cases, the length of a precedent, the idea that the longer it's been on the books, the more people have conformed their conduct to it. In other cases, they've suggested that's not such an important consideration. In Payne versus Tennessee, the case that it noted how closely divided the court was in the prior case is a factor. But in other cases, the court has said that's not a major consideration. So I put those factors on the table simply because in some cases the court looks to them, in others it doesn't. But I think the ones I mentioned yesterday are ones that apply in every case, including the settled expectations, the workability, whether the doctrinal bases of a decision have been eroded.
Yesterday, in answering Senator Specter on this very point, when you referred to Payne v. Tennessee, you did point out there were other considerations that come into play, and they're laid out again in Dickerson and in other cases, Payne v. Tennessee, Agostini, and a variety of decisions where the court has explained when it will revisit a precedent and when it will not.
Yes.
What do you think, when it should and should not?
Well, I do think you do have to look at those criteria. And the ones that I pull from those various cases are, first of all, the basic principle that it's not enough that you think the decision was wrongly decided. that's not enough to justify revisiting it. Otherwise, there'd be no role for precedent, no role for stare decisis. Second of all, one basis for reconsidering it is the issue of workability. If a precedent has turned out not to provide workable rules, if courts get different results in the similar cases because the...
Or if another case, like Casey, finds that Roe is workable.
Well, again, that's a different, that is a precedent of its own,
right,
that obviously would be looked at under principles of stare decisis. The issue of the erosion of precedent, if you have a decision that's based on three different cases and two of them have been overruled, maybe that's a basis that justifies revisiting the prior precedent. The issue of settled expectations, the court has explained, you look at the extent to which people have conformed their conduct to the rule and have developed settled expectations in connection with it. Perhaps the discussion earlier we had about the Dickerson case is a good example of that, where the Chief Justice thought Miranda was wrongly decided, but explained that it had become part of the established rules of police conduct, and he was going to respect those expectations.
Now, yesterday you said this: I agree with the Griswold Court's conclusion that marital privacy extends to contraception and availability of that. The Court, since Griswold, has grounded the privacy right discussed in that case in the liberty interest protected under the Due Process Clause. Do you think that right of privacy that you're talking about there extends to single people as well as married people?
But the courts held that in the Eisenstadt case, which came shortly after Griswold, largely under principles of equal protection. And I don't have any quarrel with that conclusion in Eisenstadt.
So, okay. Do you think that that same right extends beyond family choices, then, about a child's education?
Well, that's where it actually got started 80 years ago in the earliest cases. Meyer and Pierce involved questions about how to raise children, whether you could teach them a foreign language, whether you could send them to a private school. And those decisions are really what started that body of law.
I have another question I could ask, but you won't answer it unless...
Well, give it a try, Diane.
Well, does it cover the right of a woman to decide whether to continue her pregnancy?
Well, Senator, as I've explained, that is an area that's...
Yeah, they have to come before you, and you got right. That message was well conveyed. Could I ask you a couple, one question? I think I'll have time. In Acre v. the Republic of Iraq... This was the case where 17 U.S. prisoners, they were our people, suffered severe beatings, starvation, mock executions, dark and unsanitary living conditions, etc., during the first Gulf War, and they sued the government of Iraq, the Iraqi intelligence services, and Saddam Hussein for their brutal and inhumane treatment. The veterans won their case in district court in July of 2003. They were awarded $959 million in damages. After the judgment, the Justice Department intervened in the suit to contest the district court's jurisdiction. The specific issue involved a statutory interpretation of the Emergency Wartime Supplemental Appropriations Act, passed in 2003. Justice argued that the statute gave the president the authority to change Iraq's designation as a state sponsor of terror, and thereby relieve it, after the fact, of its responsibilities for prior acts of terror. You wrote a concurring opinion in favor of overturning the district court's judgment. Although you agreed with the other two judges on the panel that the judgment should be reversed, you alone adopted the Department of Justice's argument that the statute granted the president total power to absolve Iraq of liability. You reach this conclusion while acknowledging that the question of statutory interpretation is close. Could I ask my question?
Yes, you may finish your question.
Do you believe that when, as in Acre, there's a close question of interpretation of a statute, touching upon a foreign policy, that the executive deserves total deference?
Oh, no, Senator. Whether the question is close or not, I don't think there's any situation where a court concludes that the executive deserves total deference, and that was not the basis of my decision. The judges were unanimous that the veterans were not entitled to relief. The panel was chosen from happened to be appointees of three different presidents. The view was unanimous that they were not entitled to relief. The other two judges concluded there was no cause of action available to them. I concluded that there was no jurisdiction and wrote separately. The recognition that it was a close question is also reflected in the view of the other two judges in addressing my concern. They acknowledged that it was a close question, and I agreed with that. But you did have legislation that said that the president can determine that these laws do not apply if he makes a determination under the criteria set forth in the statute. And he had done that, and my conclusion that extended to the provision that otherwise would have allowed suit. The other two judges disagreed. They thought there was jurisdiction, but then concluded there was no right of action. So the end result of both of our position was the same. But it was not a question of deference. It was a question of interpreting the legal authority and consequences of an act that this body had passed and the president's finding under that. When it comes to interpreting questions of law, I go back to the Marbury versus Madison. That is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial branch. We don't defer to the executive. We don't defer to the legislature in making that final decision about what the law is.
To get confirmed, maybe we'll defer to the legislative a little bit. Thank you.
We defer,
thank you,
just to clarify, we certainly defer in the standards of review that make sure that we're not infringing. But the final decision about what's constitutional or not rests with the judicial branch. The policy judgments, we certainly defer to the legislature.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Feinstein. Senator Sessions.
Jeff
you,
Sessions,
Chairman,
Republican of Alabama.
Thank you for your leadership. If we move forward expeditiously, I think, today, and I think in a helpful way. I think the hearings have been very good. And Judge Roberts, I salute you for your excellent manner and your forthrightness and professionalism as you answer these questions. You know, I hope we are moving away, Senator Feinstein, from divisiveness. So we've got in some ways we do have a divided country, but in other ways I think we have the potential to move together. And I frankly believe that one thing that causes divisiveness and frustration and angst is when a Supreme Court were to render an opinion that really is more a political or social policy decision rather than a legal decision. And when they say it amounts to the Constitution, a constitutional provision, then that Supreme Court opinion can only be changed by two-thirds of both houses and three-fourths of the state. Do you understand that danger, Judge Roberts, in opinions, and is that perhaps one reason you think a judge should show modesty?
Well, it's part of what I mean when I say a certain humility should characterize the judicial function. Judges need to appreciate that the legitimacy of their action is confined to interpreting the law and not making it. And if they exceed that function and start making the law, I do think that raises legitimate concerns about the legitimacy of their authority to do that.
Well, I would observe that the American people are beginning to believe that is occurring, and I think it does threaten the legitimacy of the court in a way that all of us who love the law should be concerned. And I do love the law, and I'm a big critic of the courts on these kind of activist cases, but I have practiced full time before federal judges, and as I said earlier, I believe day after day justice is done. You have said that in your before your court, you're impressed with the objectivity and fairness that the judges bring. Is the ideal of blindfolded justice, a neutral umpire, is that a romantic, naive ideal, or is that something that you believe we can and should strive to achieve in America?
Well, I do know that there are sophisticated academic theorists, people who spend a lot more time theorizing in this area than I do, and a lot smarter than I am addressing these issues, who some of whom conclude that in particular cases it's difficult to avoid making the law while you're interpreting it, and they kind of throw up their hands and suggest that we shouldn't even try, therefore. And I don't agree with that. I think as a practical matter, as a pragmatic matter, judges every day know the difference between interpreting the law and making the law. Every day, judges put aside their personal views and beliefs and apply the law, whether the result is one they would agree with as a legislator or not agree with. The question is what the law is, not what they think it should be. I've seen that on the Court of Appeals. I've seen that as a practicing lawyer before the court. That is the ideal. I'm sure judges, I'm sure justices don't always achieve it in every case because it's a human endeavor, and error is going to affect any human endeavor. But that is the ideal, and I think good judges working hard can not only achieve it, but also achieve it together in a collegial way and benefit from the insight and views of each other.
Well, I thank you for that, and I would share those views. And I absolutely believe the strength of our nation is our good legal system. We've talked about the Commerce Clause, and there's been a lot of criticism of some of the cases. I think there have only been two significant Commerce Clause cases maybe in the last 40 years, Lopez and Morrison. Senator Feinstein, and you had a nice exchange about Lopez. I would certainly agree with your analysis. Had the Congress placed in there a requirement that the firearm had been traveled in interstate commerce, I believe that statute would have been upheld. We could pass it again with that simple requirement, and virtually every state, virtually every firearm will have traveled in interstate commerce. A few states have manufacturers. When I was a federal prosecutor, I prosecuted a lot of those cases. As a young prosecutor, I was sort of an expert at it in the 70s, and I proved sometimes that the interstate commerce by simply putting an agent on and saying there was no gun manufacturer in Alabama, or it said made in Italy on it. I remember got that affirmed one time as a proof beyond a reasonable doubt that it was not made in Alabama. So Lopez, I believe, is a good decision. Also, with regard to crime, I would note that we've always had that nexus with interstate commerce. As a federal prosecutor, it's not a prosecution for theft. It's prosecution for interstate transportation of stolen property. That's the federal crime. Theft is prosecuted only by the state courts, unless it's from a theft from an interstate shipment. That's a federal crime. It's not a stealing an automobile. It's interstate transportation of a stolen motor vehicle. The ITSMV is the federal crime. The Hobbs Act, the Extortion Act, to use against politicians, you have to have an interstate nexus. And I've had cases where bribery was proven, but we were not able to prosecute it federally because it did not have an interstate nexus. RICO, even arson cases have to have it there. And so I just want to make sure that if – let me ask you this. In general, wouldn't you agree that if someone in Pennsylvania picks up a rock and murders their neighbor, that is a crime unreachable by federal – prosecution under traditional interpretations of Commerce Clause and the reach of the federal government?
Well, again, barring special circumstances of the sort you were talking about, that's generally something addressed by state authorities.
So we need to get this thing straight. We have some people complain we're federalizing too many crimes and then complain that we're striking down some that go too far. States should prosecute these cases locally and effectively, and should do that at guns schools and guns and that kind of thing. And in the Violence Against Women's Act, it was a Commerce Clause case where a woman was raped and then sued the people who assaulted her and raped her. She wanted to sue in federal court under the Violence Against Women's Act. And what the court held there was, as I read it, that the court limited Congress's power to provide for civil damages, money damages. She could sue that rapist in state court, but not for money damages in federal court. Is that the holding of that case?
That's my understanding what the court held in the Morrison case, yes.
And I don't think it's an utterly extreme position. It certainly did not gut the Violence Against Women Act. It has a whole so many more provisions than just that. If the action had been against a private business, could the damages have been rendered in that case?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that, Senator.
I'll take the follow-up on the Garrett case that several people have mentioned involved the University of Alabama in a lawsuit against the state institution claiming a violation of the Disabilities Act. The state defended on the grounds that you could sue the state of Alabama for back pay. You could sue the state of Alabama to get your job back. You could sue the state of Alabama and get an injunction against the state to not discriminate again in the future. But under the sovereign immunity doctrine that protects a state from lawsuits, you couldn't sue them for money damages. Now, Senator Cornyn is attorney general of his state, and attorney generals like Attorney General now Judge Bill Pryor, who defended Alabama, raise that defense. And I don't think it's a bogus defense. I think it's a legitimate concern. Judge, do you recall where the doctrine that's so famous in the law that the power to sue is the power to destroy? Do you remember where that came from in our legal history?
I remember tax opinions talking about it, but the power to tax being the power to destroy. But
I think the doctrine has been applied to the states, so we attorney generals are familiar with it under the sovereign immunity that the states have. If you're empowered to sue the state of Alabama in federal court, then you have virtually the power to destroy that state financially if there's no real limit on it. And so we've always provided, and the states have provided, a sovereign immunity that the states are only allowed themselves to be sued under certain circumstances, and you cannot just sue them unnecessarily. I know Senator Mark Pryor, our Democratic colleague, signed on the brief for the state of Alabama in the Garrett case, taking this position, and the Supreme Court ruled with it. So I also would note that it did not in any way destroy the Disabilities Act. It applied to only state employees, only make up about 3.7% of the employees in the nation that might be covered by that. So I think there's been some healthy trends in reestablishing that there's some limit to the reach of the Commerce Clause. Would not you agree?
Well, the interesting thing in the court's most recent decision is the medical marijuana decision in the Raich case, and the court there looked at the Lopez and Morrison decisions and tried to put them in context and said, because the argument there was based on Lopez.